The concluding remarks of the last session actually were a perfect introduction for my topic this morning. I must tell you that initially, actually a few weeks back, I would never have imagined that I would take this topic up. So basic, so simple, yet the school I teach, the Hill Community Day School in North Miami Beach, every year, many of our students, when they graduate, they spend a year in Israel. And my students have a fairly solid philosophical foundation of Judaism. And when they go to study in Israel, they were quite shocked to hear some of the opinions and some of the beliefs of other Jewish day school students from America, from different parts of the United States, about their ideas and conceptions of God. And since clearly, if our idea of God is corrupt, then everything else must be corrupt, since God is the source of all knowledge and the source of the entire universe and all phenomena. Maimonides says as follows. Maimonides, in the Laws of Repentance, in the Laws of Tshuva, he says, the following individuals do not have a portion in the world to come. Rather, their souls are cut off, and they are judged for their great wickedness and sins forever. The Menim, the Epicurism, those who deny the Torah, those who deny the resurrection of the dead, the coming of the Messiah. Those who rebel against God, those who cause the many to sin. I forgot the book goes this way. I'm used to reading the Hebrew this way. And Maimonides lists 24 individuals that have no share in the world to come. Now I'm interested for the moment in the first category, the category that the Rambam calls Menim. Menim is a Hebrew word. It's spelled in the English M-I-N-I-M. And it comes from the word min, which basically means a type, a species. Here it means, of course, a deviant type, a deviant species. Now, what is a min? So Maimonides classifies five individuals who are defined as minim. And he says, A, one who says there is no God or ruler of the world. B, one who accepts the concept of a ruler, but maintains that there are two or more. C, one who accepts there is one master of the world, but maintains that he has body or form. D, one who maintains that he was not the sole first being and creator of all existence. E, one who serves a star, constellation, or other entity so that it will serve as an intermediary between him and the eternal Lord. So Menim, to simplify, are those who basically have a fundamental misconception about God. Now, this law in Maimonides has become quite a celebrated law, very celebrated halacha, not so much for what Maimonides said, but for what one of Maimonides' critics, the Ravad, that is an acronym for his Hebrew, Rabbi Avraham ben David, Rabbi Abraham the son of David. Now, Rabbi Avraham the son of David, the Ravad, was one of the great Torah thinkers. He was a bit older than Maimonides, and he wrote a critique on the work of Maimonides. And the Ravad, upon reading this law, this halacha, he says as follows, and he's commenting specifically on the statement about those who say that there is one God, but that he has physical or he has form. And the Ravad says as follows. He says, why does he call this type of person a min? After all, there were those greater and better than him who followed in this type of thinking, according to what they saw in the scriptures, and even more what they saw in the midrashic literature that confuses the minds. Let me read that again. Why does he call this type of person who says that there is one God, but he's physical or has form, a min, when they were greater and better, that followed in this kind of thinking, because of what they saw in the scripture, or what they saw in the midrash that confuses minds? When I originally read this Ravad to a class of 12th graders, they were very confused. Right away they said to me, and this is interesting, I don't know if this is the perception you get, they said, what's he arguing about? It's clear from the Ravad's words that he agrees with Maimonides that God forbid to think that God is physical or has form. So what's he arguing? You shouldn't call him a min? Okay, we won't call him a min. Give him a different name. When you read the Ravad, it's clear that in no way, heaven forbid, that anyone should ever think that the Ravad in any way is endorsing a physical conception of God. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. But what does the Ravad say? He says he shouldn't call them a min. The other disturbing thing is that the Ravad calls these people who make this mistake. And he says, by the way, it comes from the scriptures and from the midrashic literature that confuses the mind. So it's a confusion. So how does he call these people Gedolim V'Tovim, greater and better than Maimonides? So basically, it boils down to two points. First of all, where is the argument between the Ravad and Maimonides? It seems just to be relegated to the question of whether you call them a min. And secondly, how could the Ravad call these people better than Maimonides if they are making such a fundamental error, the most fundamental error possible in Torah? That is the conception of God. One of the great commentaries on Maimonides, the Kesef Mishnah. Kesef Mishnah was written by Rabbi Joseph Caro. Rabbi Joseph Caro was a 15th century scholar who is best known for his work, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which is the main source for all halacha in today's times. Now, Rabbi Joseph Caro says as follows upon reading this Rambam and reading this Ravad. He says, one must be very bewildered and perplexed on that holy mouth, meaning the Ravad. How could he call those who say that God is physical and has form greater and better than Maimonides? How is it possible that a holy mouth like the Ravad's, a great scholar, could ever make such a statement like that? Kesef Mishnah does not even attempt to give any kind of solution. It simply baffles the mind. It's an impossibility that one should be greater or better than Maimonides, maintaining the worst possible error in thought. But what does the Kesef Mishnah say? He says, interestingly enough, if one takes a look at a philosophical work known as the Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Fundamentals or Essentials, which was written by a great Jewish philosopher, Rabbi Joseph Albo, who lived in the 14th century, Albo quotes the Ravad's critique on this Maimonides. And guess what? It's a different version. What does it say? Here, Albo quotes the Ravad, and it says, even though the essence of all belief in faith is to believe this, i.e., that God has no physical form, has nothing, no relationship to the physical, One who believes that God has a physical form, because of his grasp of the language of the verses and the statements in the Midrash, according to their simplistic meaning, it's not fitting you should call him a min. Don't categorize him as a min. So the Kesef Mishnah quotes Albo, who quotes the Ravad, with an entirely different text. A text that does not have that impossible expression that anyone could ever be greater or better than Maimonides, and at the same time making the most fundamental flaw. But still the argument is there. We haven't dealt with the argument, namely that there is an argument between Maimonides and the Ravad, not about whether God is physical, impossible, not whether these people are in any way better or greater than Maimonides, impossible, but there's still an argument that the Ravad maintains that if a person studying the Bible on its simple level or studies Midrash on its simplistic level and comes up with the conclusion that God is physical, the Ravad maintains that that person is not to be called a min. He's not to be categorized as a min. Now, before I define in careful terms that argument, I want you to understand that there are a number of important principles that unfortunately, and I could only speak for the Jewish community at this point, that certainly the Jewish community, we don't do a very good job. And that is in the area of teaching God. We're often very busy talking about what action a person should do. Don't get me wrong, mitzvos are very important for the perfection of man. But we somehow leave out in our teaching to our children the concept of God. In fact, it is very easy to document that the first chapters of Maimonides' Code of Jewish Law, his Mishneh Torah, is absolutely, they're not studied at all. Everybody jumps a few chapters in when it gets to the practical laws, what people call practical laws. There's a book by Bachya Ibn Pakuda, the Chovas Halavavos, which means the duties of the heart. Well, I have to tell you, the first half of the first book, it usually comes in two volumes, just deals simply with the proper philosophical conception of God. That part is skipped, and they go right to the what they call the service of God. So that we have a problem that exists that we don't teach God. And perhaps people feel it's something that's too difficult or that's too philosophical. But the truth is, and I think Maimonides puts it best in the Guide for the Perplexed. And let me read to you. It's from chapter 35 in book 1. Maimonides says, "Do not think that all that we have laid down in the preceding chapters regarding the greatness and the hidden nature of the matter," meaning the matter of God, "the difficulty of apprehending it, and its having to be withheld from the multitude, refers also to the denial of the corporeality of God, and to the denial of his being subject to affections. It is not so. For just as it behooves to bring up children in the belief, and to proclaim to the multitude that God, may he be magnified and honored, is one, and that none but he ought to be worshipped, so it behooves that they should be made to accept on traditional authority the belief that God is not a body, and that there is absolutely no likeness in any respect whatever between him and the things created by him, that his existence has no likeness to theirs, nor his life to the life of those among them who are alive, nor again his knowledge to the knowledge of those among men who are endowed with knowledge. They should be made to accept the belief that the difference between him and them is not merely a difference of more and less, but one concerning the species of existence, meaning it's a qualitative difference. There can be no comparisons made. I mean to say that it should be established in everybody's mind that our knowledge or our power does not differ from his knowledge or his power, in the latter being greater and stronger, and ours being less and weaker, or in other similar respects. Inasmuch as the strong and the weak are necessarily alike with respect to their species, and one definition comprehends both of them. The minute you say one thing is stronger or weaker, one more powerful, less powerful, that means they already have a common essence, a common quality. This is impossible. So Maimonides makes it very clear, that as abstract, as philosophical, any area that approaches God, it does not change a fundamental obligation upon all of us to ensure that our children have the correct conception. And I can tell you in my own home, it works. It works. When you start telling your child, they ask questions, and you explain to them, God is not like us. And you start that at about two, three years old, by the time they get a little older, their mind is already thinking in a certain framework. In fact, sometimes when my daughter comes back from school, she'll say, you know, the teacher said something about God crying. What's wrong with her? She already knows. She already knows that this is an impossible statement to say about God. Now, she doesn't know the philosophical proofs yet. But she has the framework already. And when she gets a little older and her mind becomes more developed, then she'll start investigating these areas and to fully understand them according to the fullness of her mind and soul. I should thank David, because I'm using his Guide for the Perplexed, and it's so well highlighted. I didn't have to do any work here. So I'd like to quote two more highlights, if I may. For there is no profession of unity unless the doctrine of God's corporeality is denied. There is no unity. You cannot say, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, and at the same time have a physical conception of God. They are mutually exclusive premises. For a body cannot be one, but is composed of matter and form, which by definition are two. And then David's final highlight in that chapter, belief should be established. I'm sorry, belief should be established. Give me 1 minute here. You know what, let me leave out that last point. It gets on, it's an introduction right to the next chapter, which I'm sure you're interested in. Now, it could very well be that you are wondering at this point if there's such a fundamental idea, then what about the Torah? What about the Torah? In the Torah, one reads the hand of God, the finger of God, God's anger. One reads many various physical descriptions of the Creator. And if I may again, let me read from Maimonides, this time chapter 26, where Maimonides addresses this issue. You know the rabbinical dictum that refers in inclusive fashion to all the kinds of interpretation connected with this subject. Namely, they're saying, the Torah speaketh in the language of the sons of man. Lo dibra ha-Torah, ela kineged lashon b'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in the language of man. The meaning of this is that everything that all men are capable of understanding and representing to themselves, at first thought has been ascribed to him as necessarily belonging to God. May he be exalted. Hence, attributes indicating corporeality have been predicated of him in order to indicate that he may be exalted, exists. And Maimonides goes through the various things. But then the Maimonides says that all of this, all these various expressions in the Torah are there because the Torah, it has to be written that all human beings should be able to read and gain knowledge from the Torah. It must be written in a way that everyone can relate to it. I once gave over a concept in a particular verse in the Bible. One of my students said, well, why wasn't it written it that way? Why didn't they write that whole philosophical idea? The answer is, if the Torah was written as a book of philosophy, in abstract expression, abstract thought, how many people would be able to read this book? How many people would be able to go through the ladder and move up in the world of knowledge? It would be closed to accept a very few people. Maybe just people like Maimonides. Instead, the Torah was written in a certain way that it makes an impact on us, but at the same very time, as part of the very system of the Torah, we are teaching our children, and as they get older, with ideas and concepts, that it is impossible to maintain any physical idea of God. And therefore, any expression you find in the Torah is an anthropomorphic expression. It's there to give a certain impact to you, but God forbid you should think that its literal meaning is the description of God Himself. So that we have a system, as always. We just don't have a written word. We have a system, a method of how to approach the Torah system. And that system is such that the right concepts are handed down from generation to generation, and at the same time, the Torah remains accessible to every human being. To every human being. And that's really the greatness of Judaism. The greatness of Torah, of Judaism, is the fact that it is able to address the world of ideas to all people. That's what it's able to do. So that I can study the Torah when I'm in ninth grade, when I'm 14 years old, and gain a certain level. And then when I revisit it when I'm 35, I gain a new understanding. And when I become more sophisticated, if I'm older even, new ideas. That's how the system of Torah operates. But the key thing is that it does not, the scriptures do not stand as a part from Torah Sheba'al Peh, from the oral system. It never does. And that's the way it was handed down at Sinai. So therefore, I want you to understand that, unfortunately, it's a historical tragedy that for some people, and I guess that's why Maimonides is addressing this, he was aware of this problem in his generation, that some people unfortunately received the literal midrashim, the literal scriptures, but unfortunately were not given the proper education, the proper oral law regarding the conception of God. And I tell you that the problem that Maimonides is addressing here, and that the Ravad is mentioning, that he notices, is a problem that exists in our day as well. At the beginning of my talk, many of my students, I said, are in Israel this year. You cannot believe what they say regarding God. I think it would be an absolute shock to hear students who have been studying in various schools, learning Judaism their whole lives, but no one has ever given the proper idea of God. There is a vacuum in this area. It's a very big problem. And I'm not going to address what the causes, I think, of that problem are, but nevertheless, it's a problem, and it's something that we need to correct. we need to correct. And clearly this is something that, coming from a world that's being bombarded from a Trinitarian level, clearly this becomes all the more important. It's interesting. I had a debate just 2 weeks ago, in fact, in a ninth grade class. And these are ninth graders. Jewish ninth graders. Half the class from Orthodox homes. They wanted to know what was wrong with a Trinitarian conception of God. I mean, they had no idea. No one had ever spoken to them about this. As a matter of fact, there's one girl in the class who is a convert. Her grandmother is Protestant. And she came over to me. She's a very sweet girl. I guess she thought she was going to offend me, but I don't get offended when it comes to knowledge and discussing ideas. She came over, she goes, "You know, my grandmother, she believes in the Trinity. And she was talking to me about it. I don't believe in it, but I want you to give me a reason logically why I shouldn't. Okay, you understand? I'm not trying to offend you, Rabbi. I'm not going back, but I want to understand." I thought it was great. And in fact, I took her question. I asked if it would be okay if I presented it to the whole class, and which is what occurred. We worked on it for 4 days instead of teaching Deuteronomy that week. I was wondering what the reaction was going on back at home. I didn't get any phone calls, so I guess I was safe. But parents are spending $7,000 to send their kids for a Jewish education when we just study all week, we study Trinity. So this topic has become very, very important. There's also a story told, and I think, unfortunately, this is something that's very true today. And I know that Rabbi Chait attempted to address it in a letter to a leading Anglo-Jewish newspaper, the Jewish Press, but the final letter was not published, which I think would have clarified this area and hopefully would give the correct notions to many people. The story told that somebody came to Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was the rabbi in Brisk, which was a small city, in right on the border of Lithuania, Russia. And they came over to him and they said, "Listen, there's a certain person who is really a very wonderful person. Very wonderful person, and he does all the mitzvos and he keeps all the Torah laws. But you know, when he prays, he thinks of God being an old man with a white beard." And the Chaim looked and he said, in Yiddish we say, it's nevach, like unfortunate, but he's a heretic. So that if that basic idea, the most fundamental idea, is not clear, everything else that emerges from it is corrupt and becomes worthless. That's a big problem today. I find more and more, when I speak to people, matter of fact, I get very nervous speaking to people now about these topics, that when they're standing before God, or when they say they're standing before God, the physical imagery is there. And they somehow imagine, I guess it would be in our language, in my language, for my world, a kind old Zaidi, a kind old grandfather who's looking down upon them. And that, of course, violates the fundamentals of Torah thinking. Now, coming back to the argument between Maimonides and the Ravad, I think it's abundantly clear that in no way does the Ravad argue on the essential point with Maimonides, namely that it is a horrible, it's the greatest possible tragedy, the worst loss of knowledge to have a misconception about God. What the Ravad is arguing here, and it, and I'll try to be as clear as possible in describing this. And Rabbi Chait, if you feel I'm going, feel free to jump up. And it's important to understand this, Rabbi, but I'll tell you, because you're an educated group, but you're going to eventually come across this and wonder about it. So I think it's good that we discuss this and have a clear concept when you come by. Oh yeah, I know that, Rabbi, sure. Oh no, he doesn't mean that. You'll already be armed and ready, you know, for any cocktail get-togethers. The Ravad's argument is, he was against Maimonides classifying this person as a min, meaning that he was against the classification that this person is a denier of God. Because what the Ravad is saying is, that if we would walk over to this person and we'd ask him, what do you believe in? So this person would say, I believe in Torah. Whatever the Torah says, I believe in. That is, I am convinced of it. I'm convinced of the truth of Torah 100%. But now, unfortunately, he has misread the Torah. He has made a mistake within the Torah system about a particular formulation. But if we would show him immediately that the Torah could never mean such a thing, that God was physical, and we would show him that it has to be an anthropomorphic expression, and we would show him that Unculus, the great proselyte commentator, spent the majority of his commentary outruling such conceptions and mistakes about the verses, and we would show this to them and explain to them how the Midrash works, that the Midrash cannot be taken literally, that never in a million years did the rabbis of the Talmud and Mishnah ever think anyone would believe that there could be flying elephants. If we would show him that, he would merely say, he would change his mind. He'd say, that's it. I believe what the Torah believes. So that in his, according to the Ravad, in his essential approach, he is attached to the truth. The problem is, he makes an error within that system. According to the Ravad, that should not be classified as a min. Whereas according to Maimonides, Maimonides says, basically, I hear the nature of the error. I'm not saying it's intentional. But in the final analysis, does this individual have the right concept of God? And according to Maimonides, if he doesn't, then he is a min, and it's impossible for him to have a share in the world to come. So in no way is this an argument. Don't let anyone ever tell you, oh yeah, we saw in Maimonides that there's an argument about whether God's physical. Impossible. It's an argument of a technical nature about the definition of min. And according to the Ravad, since this man's essential belief is attached to the system of Torah, so therefore he is, according to the Ravad, that is, essentially related to the truth. Although he makes an error within that system. Whereas according to Maimonides, Maimonides rejects such an approach, and maintains that such a person in the final analysis has the wrong concept of God. And therefore, he cannot have a share in the world to come. So that is the argument between Maimonides and Ravad. As I said from the outset, I think it's a very important topic. I hope I haven't bored you with, because maybe this is so simple. I mean, your whole lives have been to is been involved in this area. But for coming from my perspective, as I said, in the Jewish world, it's a real problem. It's a tremendous problem. And unfortunately, I would say that as much as a Jew would say that he doesn't in any way have any relationship to any Trinitarian approach, unfortunately he does conceptualize God many times with physical attributes. And this is a very, very serious problem. Yes? Wait, you're getting get me in trouble.
Now? Yeah. Now, very good. I am only a student of Scripture, and I agree with your understanding that we do not know the true concept of God. I feel I don't either. And you've explained that, but now you fail to tell me where I, as a student, what sources can I use, or is there anything written you would recommend that I, so I could understand, so I could teach it to my children, and especially now grandchildren, a proper source where someone like me would certainly get mixed up in Torah. I need a teacher or a source.
I would suggest I'll give you a particular book, but then I'm going to attach a little qualification to it. I would recommend, and I open up to any of the rabbis in the audience if you have who has another alternate advice. I would suggest the book Chovat HaLevavot, which is written. Sorry about that. Duties of the Heart, which has been translated into the English, but, and here comes the qualification, that after you go through every chapter, I think it would be very important, extremely important, if maybe you would call maybe myself, Rabbi Moskowitz, Rabbi Chait, one of us, and review that chapter and make sure the ideas are absolutely clear, because there you're dealing already with certain philosophical proofs and approaches. So therefore, and by the way, it would be good for me too. Excellent to always review these ideas. So I think that's a good starting point. That's where he starts his book, The Unity of God. But I think it's important that you review your concepts and your impressions and go through the proof and talk it over with someone who has more intimate knowledge in this area. In this way, you'll be sure you have exactly the idea and you'll be able to transmit it as a true teacher.
All right.
Where is this available?
We have, it's easy. It's easy to get.
Yep.
It's easy. No problem.
There you go.
I'm reading from the Tanakh, a passage that perhaps this gentleman had read before he came up and talked to the good rabbi. And I'm wondering how the rabbinical schools would interpret this. Thrones were set in place. The one Ancient of Age took his seat. His robe was as white as snow. The hair of his head was as pure as wool. The throne of his blazing flames, wheels and burning fire. Thousands times thousands waited on him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The courts were held. The books were opened.
Ezekiel?
That's the book of Daniel.
That's Daniel, okay.
Daniel 9, somewhere around there.
It's Daniel 7.
Well, close.
Well, I would need to look at the particular psukim in detail, but I would say this. Over there you're dealing with prophecy. That in no way is a description of God. It's a description of certain ideas that were transmitted to Daniel, and in fact you should know that if you study the area of prophecy, and every area is an area of knowledge, and prophecy is part of that, you will find out that the prophet just didn't receive like ready-made information. He had to engage in the perceptions that he perceived. It was a process of knowledge. He had to interpret it, understand it, so that the prophet was involved in a quest of knowledge within the framework of prophecy. So that prophecy is not giving a description of God in any literal sense. Instead, it's conveying certain concepts that were important to be conveyed to Daniel. Now, I don't know what those particular concepts, as I said, and I don't know even if I studied it right now, I would understand it necessarily. But that's the approach that one must take.
I would say, based on the study of prophets also, and I was going to save it till the end, and this is not to even try to take away from what Gene was saying, but God speaks to prophets one way at one time and another way at another time, and the prophets will explain what he's seeing, and then at other times God will speak to him again and he will have additional information. To preface that, I would say, and then your book, The Duties of the Heart, written to Daniel, and you get in there and Daniel writes a letter and then there's a response to him. But when you look in this book, The Duties of the Heart, there's some dialogue going on in the book. Hello? Okay, all right, good.
Okay.
All right. But see, now I would go, my recommendation would not be that book, although it's good.
Okay.
My recommendation would be the guide on the incorporability of God and the absolute oneness of God. And when I studied the guide for the first time in my life after probably some 20 plus years of searching, I came to grips with the concept of the incorporability of God. And I paraphrase this, and the people have been here have heard it many times on the tapes. And I said that when you comprehend that God is incomprehensible, then that is the first comprehension that you have of God.
Right.
All right. Now, that's it.
Yeah. Well, David, I would say that I'd be the last person on earth, probably, and you could find out from people in Miami that would never tell people not to read the God. The guide most certainly could read.
Right,
the reason why I suggested Chovar al Vovos as against the guide was because Maimonides, he states things, but it's not given in a philosophical proof form.
I understand.
He makes hints, he makes allusions, he makes statements. It's not given as you would read a Socratic dialogue, whereas in the Duties of the Heart, it is presented that way.
I want to get these questions into. But see, I am thoroughly convinced beyond any shadow of doubt or compromise that the whole idea of Avodah Zarah lies in the idea of God. Every aspect of a person's relationship or trying to maintain the relationship is due to his comprehension and concept of God. And when you come to the fact that God is incomprehensible, then you can begin from that level to understand how does God interact, why does God do what he does. Back to Rabbi Chait's lecture on Sunday morning that he will work on this evening, and in the same ideas, then my lecture on Wednesday evening is the questions of God to men.
I wanted to just quote a quick Maimonides.
Yeah, I'm through.
On that thought you just said, Maimonides says, the thought of the heretic is to idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when I begin to formulate God into my theological position, I have at that point committed idolatry. And see, that is so subtle a point. It's so subtle.
Yeah.
And see, that is the problem that people have in the concept of God, because we are in a four sense world, whichever, even six sense world. But even working in the metaphysics, you still have to limit yourself in the idea and concept of God.
Okay, the question I have has to do with helping to purge us of the wrong concept. Even in the Torah, in Genesis, man was made in the image of God. And even in Exodus, is what I was originally going to ask, when God was given the Ten Commandments to Moses, he says, "For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God." That's a human-like attribute. Now, to help us to clear up, we realize we wish to strive towards the right and pure concept of God, but these are things that would tend to help hold us back. And if we could have these cleared up, and purge us of the wrong
I want the mic to go to Rabbi Chaitin's, but before it does, I just want to tell you, excellent question.
I would like to state it as follows, and you have to just understand that the Torah is a very in-depth system of philosophy and psychology, and psychology is extremely important. And I try to avoid a lot of times using psychological terms because I know some people don't, you know, look askance at it, but you have to understand that this is something which perhaps the world has come to understand rather recently, but Torah has explained to us and understood it thousands of years ago. And that is, there is a very primitive, dark side of man. This dark side of man tries and believes that the physical is the real. So therefore, in order for them to believe in God, they must make him physical, and they must perceive him through the senses, whereas Torah maintains exactly the opposite, that the real is an underlying reality, not the physical that we sense. Science recently has confirmed this. We always thought that this is something which is solid. Actually, it's not. There's more space in it than there is matter. And the matter is in constant motion. But the way our senses interact with it, it gives us a sense, and something in our mind registers as solid. But in reality, it is completely different than the way we sense it. Torah says that that is still the creation. But God, the source of the creation, is not even to be equated with that kind of abstraction, but rather something which is completely different, the source of creation. And when a person realizes it, then he has the real, true idea of God. And making God into a physical, trying to perceive him through the senses, is a total distortion which is completely unacceptable. Now, if you read the writings of the ancient religions, you'll see they always contain these descriptions of their God. Descriptions, they call it, a theohistory. Like, a God, there was this God that, a mommy God, a daddy God, and they describe how they live and how they eat and sleep and all human attributes. Okay? There is no text like the Torah that goes back to that date that is pure, clean, removed from any kind of attempt to give you a history of God, what he looks like, what he appears like, to cater to those primitive emotions. There is nothing like that existing in the Torah. As a matter of fact, that was the thing that prompted Sigmund Freud to write his Moses and Monotheism, when he said, Moses doesn't allow me to sleep at night. His problem was, he was a person who had understood how strong the primitive instinct is. How could it be a nation 3,000 years ago writes this book, sorcery is out, idolatry is out, no images, no physical conception of God? How could such a thing be? And he tried vainly to answer it. He himself was very dissatisfied with his own answer. But I'm not going to go into that. But we know the answer. The answer is because this kind of knowledge, man could never have arrived at on his own. It would be centuries and centuries and perhaps even never. But man was given this knowledge through God's Torah. Now, I will show you, I would like to demonstrate to you what Maimonides is saying. Maimonides is saying that whenever the scripture uses an analogy, an anthropomorphic expression, it is only there for one purpose, and that is to convey to us a certain concept. He's saying here that the Torah assumed that people would teach, as Rabbi Bald said, would teach their children that from early youth that God is not to be conceived in a physical way. So when they see this, they'll know immediately there is something that the Torah is trying to teach us. Not that it is literal. Okay. Now I'll show you why that has to be so. Just from a logical analysis of the scripture, there are two reasons why you would use an anthropomorphic kind of expression. One is, of course, you want to satisfy that desire, that primitive instinct to make God physical. That's one reason. Another reason is, as Rabbi Bald mentioned, to teach you an idea. Now, if you look at Torah, you will never find a catering to that kind of instinctual drive. Otherwise, you'd have descriptions of God eating, sleeping, doing things like you have in all the writings that date back to the same time of the Torah, and all those primitive writings. You would have that kind of catering to that instinct. You see, you have to have a certain sensitivity here. When you read those primitive writings, and I would suggest that you read them, as Maimonides says, that when you study the primitive, you will understand Torah more, because the Torah is the exact opposite of the primitive. If you read some of those writings, you'll sense right away, you see right away what they're getting at, you see the emotion right there, In the Torah, you never find that. Does Genesis begin with a description of the Creator? How he looks? What he seems like? Not a word. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. No description. If you look honestly at the Torah, you will see that there is a total avoidance of any kind of catering to the instinctual. So now you see, but yet we do have these anthropomorphic statements. The reason is clear, because if you look at every statement and you analyze it, you'll see it is trying to teach you one thing. When it says God is angry, it's trying to teach you that this deed is an incorrect deed. When it says God is satisfied, happy, or tries to indicate that what it's trying to indicate is this deed is a correct deed in the eyes of God. And it couldn't be stated in abstract philosophical terms, because then it would be impossible for anybody to read it. It would be volumes and volumes. But it states it in a simple metaphor, so that you know immediately when you study the action that it's referring to, you know immediately whether this is a correct action in the eyes of God or an incorrect action in the eyes of God. You'll never find descriptions of God eating or sleeping or doing any of those things, because that is catering to the primitive. But you'll find God is displeased, God is angry, or God is satisfied, or it's certain statements where you see the finger of God, which means that it's obvious that this action stems from the Creator. But every one of those things, if you study them, always in relationship to man. In other words, always to teach man the idea, the true concepts with regard to his action and to his way of life. And if you just read it objectively, you'll see that that is quite clear.